KQED.
From KQED FM Radio, welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. Wine sales are up, and so are the number of words and phrases wine critics use to describe the taste of their favorite or least favorite beverages. People spend days touring wine regions like the Napa Valley tasting wines. Wine bars are popping up all over. People are studying the shelves of wine stores like they would a library. Can they tell the difference? What makes a wine taste good? And is a bottle of wine worth, say, $20 or $30 or $40 or more? Who's to say? This hour, we look at the concept of wine snobism. We've got three well-schooled experts with us, and we'll certainly want to hear from you. So join us right after this. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. The American writer Fran Lebowitz has been quoted these days as saying, "Great people talk about ideas, average people talk about things, and small people talk about wine." If you're a wine drinker, and more Americans are wine drinkers, that's a pretty hefty insult. But she's not the only one who takes on wine snobs. Remember the 2004 movie Sideways with Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church? While it inspired some people to drink wine, it took a few shots at over-the-top wine enthusiasts as well. There was this scene at a bar where Giamatti is teaching Church how to drink wine.
Really get your nose right in there, really. A little citrus. Maybe some strawberry. Passion fruit. And, oh, there's just like the faintest soupçon of like asparagus, and there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Wow. Strawberries, yeah.
Good.
Strawberries.
Yeah.
Not the cheese.
I never tasted a wine that tasted like asparagus, but anyway, later on they talk about Merlot, but not very nicely. You get the idea. So we're going to talk about wine and wine taste and wine snobs this hour, and let's get to us. With us is Leslie Zabracco, who's a wine author and a consultant. She's the host of Check Please Bay Area on KQED Television. How you doing, Leslie?
Good, Spencer. How are you?
Good, good. Julia Flynn Seiler is with us. She's with the Wall Street Journal. She writes business news and specializes in wine. She's the author of The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty, which was published in June. Good morning to you, Julia.
Good morning, Spencer.
And also Fred Franzia is with us by phone from Ceres, California, which is near Modesto. He is the president and CEO of Bronco Wine Company, which makes Charles Shaw brand of wines sold at Trader Joe's, and everybody knows it as Two Buck Chuck. Good morning to you, Fred Franzia.
Good morning.
So what do you think, Fred? Is there a problem with wine snobs, or is it a healthy thing?
I think the people that enjoy wine and drink wine is a healthy thing. I think people that talk about it and try to confuse us is not healthy.
Is there some rationale for people who really look into wine and worry about where it was grown and what kind it is and whether it tastes like asparagus or nuts or whatever? Is there something to be said for that?
I'd say they got a real inferiority complex.
Why do you say that?
But why do you have to complicate it and muddy it up and confuse people? Wine is something to enjoy. Certainly isn't something to complicate or compare to asparagus or apricots or tobacco or whatever else they have words for.
But, you know, Spencer, I do have to chime in here.
And this is Leslie. Go ahead.
As the author of two books and a writer that really tries to, I'm sorry for this overused word, demystify wine, but I try to make wine fun and enjoyable. And I agree with Fred. You know, there is a place for there is a place for this wonderful wine talk, the geek speak, as we call it, or purple prose.
What's the place for it?
The place for it is, I think, if you're really into wine and you love to explore it and try wines from Burgundy, try wines from You know, and you can go into the minutiae of wines from various appellations in Burgundy. Just like you have golf enthusiasts or baseball enthusiasts who get into, you know, I can't stand to listen to my husband talk about baseball. You know, you can get into that, but really, ultimately, wine is to enjoy. So you can enjoy it on many different levels is the key.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
I'm saying that you can enjoy it, drink it, and that's my motto, enjoy it and drink it. But there is also a place to be able to delve into it, to really enjoy talking about the terroir or the place it comes from, to being able to explore wines from around the world and share that with people who are interested in it as well. It doesn't have to be either or.
The terroir. Fred Franzia, you had an interesting quote in a story I read about the terroir. You said you could grow wine on asphalt.
and you could grow grapes. I said not wine, but you could make grapes grow through asphalt if you water it.
You're kidding, of course,
no,
right?
I'm not. No,
you're
I'm not.
No, he's right. It's true. You could.
Well, I mean, is that wine going to taste? Is that wine going to taste as good as a bottle of Kunde?
Might taste better.
It might taste better. We'll be hearing from Kunde. All right, that's interesting. But let's hear from Julia Flynn Seiler. What do you make of this? Is there a place for high-flown descriptions of wine and all that?
Well, I approach this as simple economics. And there are certain wines, such as Screaming Eagle, which is known as a cult wine. The first vintage of Screaming Eagle, they only made 200 cases of it. And when it got a 99-plus rating from Robert Parker, everybody wanted this.
All right, Robert Parker is a big wine writer, the Wine Spectator.
He has his own newsletter called The Wine Advocate.
The Wine Advocate.
Sure, but he's the most powerful critic in the world. And so for people who price didn't matter to, but really the fermented grape juice was all about the prestige, they wanted that wine. And, you know, as it went on, what happened was that there was a long waiting list. You couldn't buy the wine very easily. And now you can get on eBay and get it for about $3,000 a bottle.
But $3,000 a bottle?
Yeah, $3,000 a bottle. And one of the most extreme cases I saw was in researching my book, The House of Mondavi, I went to a $1,000 a person tasting of 10 Screaming Eagle wines. It was a very, very elite tasting of every single vintage ever produced. And people were so anxious to try this wine that the wannabes, the people who didn't want to pay $1,000 head, the sommeliers and other people, were behind a rope. And when the paying customers finished, the people who were behind the rope snuck in and sipped this wine, tasted the dregs because they wanted to taste this fabled stuff. But, of course, you know, it's all fermented grape juice, isn't it?
Well, what do you make of that, Fred Franzia, with Blanco wine?
The bottle on his throw up. So let me tell you, for people to waste air time talking about something that's a fantasy, it doesn't deal with reality. No, Julie, I don't mean this as a personal thing, but you know, I think Parker and the wine, whatever it's called, wine spectator.
Advocate?
Wine spectator, whatever it is, speculator. And do a disservice to the industry when they make a wine like a Screaming Eagle, something that everybody wants and can't afford to drink. And when they do get their hands on these high ratings, normally the wines are so harsh they can't drink them. So the average consumer says, well, if I can't enjoy the best, supposedly best by experts, I'm not going to drink any wine. They do a great disservice to the wine industry.
And I think ratings have gotten too powerful. That's the issue with ratings, is they have gotten to the point, and not necessarily that it's Robert Parker's fault. It's not. It's just that consumers have glommed onto these ratings as an easy way to help them navigate the wine aisles. And retailers, by the way, have used them to their advantage.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that Blanco Wine's two-buck chuck, Charles Shaw, has won a couple or more than a couple of pretty interesting awards. Just recently, a Chardonnay came in first at the California State Fair, and I think earlier some of the red wines have done pretty well. And this is wine that you can buy at Trader Joe's for $2 a bottle. Fred Franzia, how do you do that? And what do you think of winning these awards that you think are so sort of phony in the first place?
Well, I said that ratings, private ratings by individual people like Parker or Wine Spectator in a closed room with no judges watching the judges is a disgrace. what I'm saying, a California state fair who no one knows who the judges are, taste 400 wines and pick the Shaw out as the number one Chardonnay over wines at any price category, I say that that type of tasting we embrace because we win those every day. Over 300 million consumers have purchased Charles Shaw wines, and they're happy customers.
What did you say, 3 million?
300 million.
300 million? There aren't that many people in the United States.
I know. So far, we've only averaged one bottle per person. We're looking to get it up to 12.
Fred, so tell us the secret. Where did that Chardonnay come from? Was that bulk wine that you purchased from the likes of Beringer or Mondavi, or was this wine that you grew?
You know, first of all, nice of you to bring up Beringer and Mondavi in the same breath with us. But our family's been in business for 110 years in California, and we've been a backbone supplier of wines to a lot of labels, and as well as our own label. We grow grapes, as most of you know. We're the largest single grape grower in the state.
Mostly in the Central Valley, right?
In the San Joaquin Valley. I don't know where the Central Valley is, but the San Joaquin Valley...
I know where it is.
...is the richest valley in the world, and it's 300 miles long and 100 miles wide. So we get a lot of variations in temperatures. And if the growth of the wine in America is going to be where I think it's going to be over the next 10 years, the next 100 million cases are going to come out of the San Joaquin Valley. They're not going to come out of Napa or Sonoma.
But going back to Julia Seiler's question, which was where did that Chardonnay that won the prize come from?
Well, Julia was here at the winery, and she made a special blend up of our tanks. And she said those were the best, and so we bottled that and put it into the award-winning ceremony, and she won the award for us.
I think you're joshing us.
Oh, Julie's got a great taste. You know, she goes from Screaming Eagle down to Charles Shaw. I'm all for her.
I don't know, Fred. I'm really a $15 and under kind of gal, but I find it so fascinating the way that you have challenged the attempt by Napa Valley to really create very much along the French, clubby French wine scene, their own brand name, their own geographical place names, their appellations. And, you know, you've really challenged the wine establishment. And I really find that fascinating.
How has he challenged it? He likes to put Napa on his own label. And I had a little Charles Shaw last night, a Chardonnay, not bad, by the way. And it said, you know, Bronco Wine Company, Napa, California.
Did it say vinted in Napa, California?
No.
I think if you read it carefully, it said Charles Shaw Winery, Napa, California. That's the bottling location of the winery.
But doesn't that give you the impression that the wine is really from Napa?
Well, now let me tell you something. Wines have been bottled in Napa for 50 years, 90% of which aren't produced from Napa Valley grapes. So it's nothing new, if that's what you're wondering, if we're breaking new ground there. And if you look at some of the bottles, you'll see Sonoma on them, too. We bottle at Sonoma also.
Leslie, what do you think about Charles Shaw winning all these awards?
Well, I've judged on many panels. I judged the San Francisco International Wine Competition as well as Los Angeles, and both of those are two of the largest in the country. And I know that Charles Shaw has done well. And it is a very egalitarian way to judge wine. That's, everything is blind. You don't know what you're tasting. But so I think it's terrific. Again, there are very, very good low-priced wines. You cannot equivocate price all the time with quality. Absolutely not. So especially in this day and age of you know, high-quality winemaking and the techniques are so advanced that you can have very, very affordable wines that are absolutely stunning and delicious.
You just said something, though, that confused me. Aren't all wine tastings blind? I mean, if you know what
you're drinking. No, absolutely not.
You mean people know what they're drinking and
of course
then
they do.
Well, that would seem to be a sort of a phony way to judge a wine.
Of course.
Duh.
Many wine writers, it just depends upon, now, it depends upon if somebody's a columnist and they're tasting wine and writing about it. It depends upon if they're on a tasting panel. It depends upon if they're judging in a competition. So there are many, many ways. It can go from, yes, you know, you've gone to a property and you're interviewing winemakers. I'll be in Burgundy next week and I'll be interviewing winemakers. I will know what they're pouring. So if I'm writing about it, I'll know that. But there are tasting panels that absolutely don't taste blind.
Will you, as a wine writer, accept free wine from these people?
Yes, I have. In all my capacities, I used to work for the New York Times Company.
I don't think that's an issue. A bottle of wine isn't going to influence the wine writer to write or not write.
Unless it's Screaming Eagle and you get a whole case
of
it.
I don't believe even in that case. What it is a tasting panel. I'd love for every wine writer to have a bottle of Screaming Eagle to taste next to my Charles Shaw Cabernet or on a comparable basis, and then tell me why one's worth 3,000 times more than mine.
Well, or even
1,800 or 10 times as much.
So I
think the wine writers do a service when they taste everything they get their hands on and make judgments. I think that's healthy.
Okay. Julia had a comment.
I do have a comment, which is I think that there is a big issue with accepting free trips and free wine on the part of wine writers. And it brings them too close to the industry, and they're reluctant to criticize the industry or look at it as clearly as they might have. I had a very interesting experience, again, in writing a story for the Wall Street Journal about Screaming Eagle, and I go to the winery, which was the home of Gene Phillips, the founder, and lovely lady, and she presents me with a bottle of Screaming Eagle. It's worth at least $3,000 with my name inscribed in it in gold ink. Wall Street Journal policy does not allow me to accept something like that, and she refused to take it back, and finally I ended up having to just set it on her doorstep. But I think there's a big issue. You cannot be objective if you're accepting gifts, and that's why the Wall Street Journal doesn't allow us to do that.
Really, if I gave you a $2 bottle of my Shaw, would you not accept that?
No, I wouldn't accept it. I go out and buy it. I buy it, Fred.
Well,
I was there yesterday.
As a wine writer, you have to go out and buy as well, and you have to. It depends. Julia, there's no one-set policy, unless when I worked for the New York Times, as you work currently for the Wall Street Journal, there are policies in place. And there are policies in place at the Wine Spectre. There are policies in place at the San Francisco Chronicle. So
all right.
It depends upon which publication you're working with and working for. I can see.
I'm glad we're all, though, on the right side of this thing. And I work for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. We don't take anything from anybody. But once in a while, we'll take maybe a glass of wine. Anyway, I'm a little bit interested, before we have to take a break, which is a while from now, for Fred Franzia, how did Two Buck Chuck get going? How are you different than the usual winery or vineyard? How did you get that thing going?
Well, rather than sell it to one of my competitors at 50 cents a gallon for him to put under his brands, I put the parts together and said, well, we can sell this on the American market and make more money with it. It's all economics. And so we offered it to Trader Joe's to be able to sell it at $1.99, and they took us up on it and offered it to the consumers. They're the ones that are really unsung hero in here, because we've offered it to every chain in the California. And the only other chain that has it is Save Mart Markets that runs Fox something, it escapes me now, as a brand. And they sell it for $23.88 a case, the same thing, $1.99, to just eliminate the handling charges.
Can you make money bottling wine at $1.99 a bottle retail?
Absolutely.
If you can make that kind of money with that, what are the Napa and the Sonoma wineries making on what they sell for $20-$30 a bottle?
Well, they may have higher costs in paying for their monuments they built up there, and they probably pay more for labels and everything. I mean, you know, we buy in million units, and so we get the scale of economy down. But I'll tell you, I hope we have time today to talk about how the restaurants are overcharging on wines and taking advantage of the consumers.
You just did. How come you're only in two markets in the state of California? Everybody knows about Two Buck Chuck, who pays any attention at all. Why are you only in two different stores?
Because the boys don't want to compete and give their consumers a fair price.
Say, now, wait a minute. You're in Safeway. Because don't you make Silver Ridge?
Sea Ridge. We make Silver Ridge, too. It's another brand, but it's higher up. Sea Ridge.
Well, I found that in Safeway.
And what'd you pay for it?
It was cheap. In fact, it won an award, a blind taste test, so I went and I bought about $2 or $3 a bottle. This was about a year or two ago.
How much you pay for it?
I said about $2 or $3 a bottle.
Okay, I think you paid more than that. But that's neither here nor there. I can't tell any retailer what to sell it for. All I can tell him is what I'll sell it to him for.
So are you saying that the other distributors and the other winemakers would be angry with markets if they were selling your wine?
Oh, I don't think that anyone gets angry at anyone else. There's a consumer out there that's the most important individual, and what the customer buys and finds value, they're going to come back and build on it. We're a customer-driven brand house. We're not a retail high-margin brand house. So the customers are demanding good wines at super value pricing, and that's where we fit, why our wines have grown. Leslie, you mentioned that San Francisco tasting that you had earlier in the year.
Mm-hmm.
We had about four Napa Valley wines that we bottle under Napa Creek, Napa Valley, and a few other brands. And a lot of people don't realize we're the second largest selling company of company-owned brands in Napa Valley. The only one that sells more than us is Diageo.
Mm-hmm.
Diageo?
Absolutely. And
what is Diageo?
Diageo is a British drinks company.
About a two-foot-tall Italian guy that owns a lot of brands.
It was the combination of Guinness and Grand Met.
Can I buy Diageo wine? Or is
No. There's brands within Diageo.
I see. So go ahead. I'm sorry, Fred.
Oh, it's interesting. And none of the awards, double golds at the San Francisco Fair on our Napa Valley wines, which all sell for $10 or less, got any publicity. And then once we hit this award at the California State Fair, that our Charles Shaw $2 bottle wine won, boom, it won worldwide with on the news networks. And it just either confirms that people out there want to believe that there's value at a low price, a super value price, or the old question, how can you do it? My answer to that question, when people ask me or push me for an answer, and why don't others do it? Why don't you turn the question around and say, why are other people charging so much?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm the only guy charging the fair price out there. All the other ones are overcharging.
Julia.
So Fred, just to summarize, essentially what you're doing is you are offering bulk wines in a good, well-known brand, the Charles Shaw brand. But the criticism I hear of the Charles Shaw brand is that the quality is very inconsistent, and that is the opposite of what, say, Napa and Sonoma Valley, in terms of their joint marketing with Appalachians, is trying to address. In their case, they're trying to set up Appalachians that imply an assurance of quality. If you buy a wine from the Stag's Leap District, you know it's going to be a pretty good Cabernet. How are you tackling that kind of issue, Fred, which is, you know, sometimes it's a great Shiraz and sometimes it's a really lousy Chardonnay if you get a Two Buck Chuck?
You know what, Fred, I'm gonna hold off on the answer to that for just a minute, because we do have to take a...
I'm swinging on that one, so get ready.
All right, so we're going to take a break, and we're going to get some telephone calls from our viewers, or our listeners. The number here is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. We're talking about wine snobism and so forth. Leslie Zabracco is with us, who's a wine author and consultant and the host of Check Please Bay Area on KQED Television. And Julia Flynn Seiler, who writes for the Wall Street Journal and has a new book, The House of Mondavi. And Fred Franzia, the president and CEO of the Bronco Wine Company, Two Buck Chuck. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum from KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. This is Friday Forum, and we're talking about wine snobs, and it's a lively little discussion. Leslie Zabracco is with us, the host of Check Please Bay Area on KQED Television, a wine author and consultant, Julia Flynn Seiler, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, a lot of wine stories, and also a new book, The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. And Fred Franzia, the president and CEO of the Bronco Wine Company, the maker of Charles Shaw brands, sold at Trader Joe's, nicknamed Two Buck Chuck. So we will continue this discussion here, but why don't we take a telephone call right off the bat and see what happens. We got Wendell in Napa. Hi.
Hi. This is a fascinating topic. As a premium vintner in Napa Valley, I just wanted to say I do think that Fred Franzia is doing great things for the industry. It's a global market, but at the same time, it's a little disingenuous to suggest that, you know, wine made on asphalt will taste similarly to wine made from great vineyards. I do think that the high end of the market has been negatively impacted by two things. One, people buy wine as an investment vehicle with no intent to drink it, but rather just to sell it for a premium, which I think has had a negative impact. But also this notion of scarcity, if you make less wine, then therefore you should be able to charge that much more for it. So, you know, we make great wines, and we offer them at high-end prices, but people want those wines because they feel like they've got the nuances that make them great wines and distinguished from lower-end wines. So it's a free market, and as soon as all these wine snobs negatively impact the market, they're not going to be able to sell it. And Fred Franzia knows that, and that's probably why he's pretty excited.
All right. Fred, you want to answer that? I think one of the implied things there is that people actually know what they're drinking and they appreciate the subtlety and the complexity of wines, and I don't know whether Fred agrees with that.
Oh, I don't know where the question was there. I must have missed it.
Julia?
Well, yeah, I have a comment about it. There's kind of a joke in our public school, and we have a auction every year, and there's always the wine component of it. And the joke is that these wines never get drunk. They get auctioned off year after year after year, and there is an element of investment, and also just buying a bottle of wine not for any of the subtleties, any of the nuance, any of the terroir, but as a sign of prestige. And you know, you're not going to put up a bottle of Two Buck Chuck at an auction and get any money for it.
Well, the question is, are you going to take a bottle of Two Buck Chuck to your friend's house when you've been invited for dinner?
Well, probably
even
not.
Even if it's good, that seems kind of funny. Fred, do you run into that?
Oh, I probably get 1,000 letters a month from consumers saying how proud they are to serve our wines and that the value that's so consistent. Don't want to hurt Julia's feelings, but she mentioned our wines are inconsistent. It's just the opposite of way. We produce tanks in 700,000-gallon batches, or about 300,000 cases. It's very, very unlikely that they're inconsistent.
Well, that's
what that shows, what Wendell said and what Fred said.
This is Leslie.
This is Leslie. There is a market for wines, affordable wines, low-end wines, bargain wines, whatever you want to call them, everyday wines. And there's a market for those people who want to spend more money on wine to experience different terroirs, different appellations, different kinds of wine. So it doesn't have to be one or the other.
The idea of inconsistency, Fred, you were sort of riled up about that before we took the break. I mean, I can sort of see what Julia is saying, that sometimes you buy a bottle of Charles Shaw and it tastes pretty good and you're amazed, and sometimes you buy one and you say, maybe I should use this for cooking. I mean, is this just the difference between two people's perception?
Let me tell you the answer is, okay? People who drink wine every day, the same wines, like drinking coffee every day or drinking tea, if they consistently drink the same, those guys are the most important drinkers, those ladies, because when they don't like something, they know there's a change. People who jump in and out of tasting a wine, you may have had to be hung over from the night before or had a bad dinner or some high-flavored dinner that the next day when you taste wine, you're still tasting the after effects of it. But if you drink the same wine 6 days in a row and you think it's inferior wine, then I'll pay you back all the money you paid for. I mean, we're very, very confident that we make these wines consistently the same. It's the people that are drinking them that are inconsistent because they don't drink them every day.
How, if you making wines...
Do you understand that one?
Oh, I understand what you're saying, but it sort of implies that what you're doing is you are really using your taste buds to try to make that wine consistent, that in fact there are differences between wines.
Of course there are.
There's more inconsistency in Stag Leap, and we buy a lot of their wines. We have it available. I had it last night for dinner, Stag Leap Petite Sirah, under my Napa Creek label, was a really good wine. And we consistently buy those wines when they're available to us, but we taste every wine out of Napa and Sonoma that goes on the bulk market. And let me tell you, for the record, 2/3 of the wine sold in Napa Valley goes out the back door, not the front door.
What does that mean?
You figure it out. 2/3 of the wine sold in Napa goes out the back door, not the front door.
That's the secret, Fred. This is Julia, which is a lot of times you will, you know, uncork a bottle of Two Buck Chuck and you're drinking Napa, beautiful Stag's Leap or something else wines, aren't you?
I'll believe it for a minute.
Don't believe it. Is that what he means by goes out the back door?
It goes out the back door. It goes to the bulk market is what he's saying.
Right.
Why would that be? Why would a wine company that pays a huge amount for its land and is charging a lot of money for its wine under its own label, why is it going to sell that wine out the back door cheaper?
Because he can't sell it out the front door. Consumers are backing up out there. And so to keep his image up, he pretends he's selling it all at the front door at the high price. Meanwhile, he's going out the back door.
So the question is then, how do you find out where to get the back door wine cheaper?
They call me. I take care of them.
Okay. Let's take a call from Tim in Napa. Hi, Tim.
Hi, everybody. How's it going?
All right.
You know, I've got a comment. My name's Tim Hanna. I'm the first American to pass a Master of Wine examination.
Hi, Tim.
And hey, Leslie, how are you doing? Hey,
Fred, how are you?
I'm having a blast. You know, the thing that I get is what we're arguing about is fundamental human nature, and there's such a lack of understanding. I do work in how we are biologically different, one human to the next, and what we don't pay attention to is there can be a 100-fold difference in the number of taste buds one human being has to the next. And most typically, the people with the least taste buds are the most noteworthy wine experts. And it's just a simple biological fact. It's provable. The people with the most taste buds are white Zinfandel drinkers. And so we've kind of lost touch of, you know, understanding the market rather than arguing about who's right and who's wrong. And it's just kind of interesting from my perspective in studying this phenomenon. So it's interesting to note that human beings operate from sensory perception. We're radically different in what we experience. And then we have our personal value systems. And so it just sort of collapses around the table instead of community and understanding to argument.
Well, we hope that we are adding to some of that understanding, and maybe they should label wines with what kind of taste buds you have. I don't know. Anyway, let's take another call from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the conversation here. I've bought Two Buck Chuck and Trader Joe's myself, and think that, Fred, you're doing a great thing for the industry. I also rely on a couple of boutique wine places in my area in San Francisco, on Terraville, San Francisco Wine Trading Company, and Wine Impressions in the Laurel Plaza area. And these people have been very good at steering me toward wines that fit my budget. But I must say that I don't drink Two Buck Chuck much anymore. I use it for cooking, and I occasionally serve it and drink it and enjoy it, but it doesn't consistently have the quality that I find in bottles even under $15 or under $10 that are recommended to me by somebody who's tasted them and understands them and can articulate with language what that wine has that I might or might not
well,
be looking
for. Well, the key to this whole discussion, though, is quality. What does it mean when a wine has quality? Our last viewer or listener seemed
well,
to...
I could quote Clement Greenberg, the art critic, who said, "Quality art is quality, and I know what it is."
and that's what he stood on.
How is the Supreme...
Maybe Robert Parker does the same thing, but I can taste the difference when I taste it, and particularly when I drink it with food that is going to match it. And that's why I think the language is very important. When somebody talks about, you know, leather, tobacco, or whatever they're talking about, they are actually talking about esters that are in the wine that are the very same chemical compound that you can get in red peppers or green peppers, and that if I'm trying to match that wine with food, and I'm an amateur gourmet chef, just cooked for my friends, but it's great for me if I can go into Wine Impressions and say, look, I'm making a torta de funghi porcini, I want a Chateau Neuf to pop, what do you think? And he says, I've got a great mushroomy, earthy, and he was right. It was terrific.
All right, Fred, how do you react to that kind of description?
What was the gentleman's name in San Francisco? I'm sorry, I missed it.
I cut him off, so I forget already, but
right.
Anyway.
What I would suggest to the fellow is get the bottle that is being recommended by his friend that's probably doubling or tripling his profit. He probably paid $5 for that bottle, and he's selling it for $15. So he's got a $10 bill in it. So he's going to sell it real well. But I would suggest to him to have one of his gourmet friends blindly pour three glasses of all the items that he's drinking. At the end of the evening or the end of the meal, see which glass is empty. And if Shaw's the last one emptied, I'll eat my hat.
What about the description that people use today for wine? I mean, we sort of started with that.
Elder wash. You know what I mean?
Well, but everything you talk about has to have a language. Again, whether it's golf or whether it's insurance or whether it's food, there has to be a language attached to it, whether that language is something that
you... good, and I like it.
Yeah, again...
Yeah, there's a good wine, and I like it. Thank you very much.
Well, and it's so interesting, isn't it, the way that popular tastes, there's almost a backlash from the critics such as Robert Parker and these very high alcohol, very dense wines. And people are moving back away from that, aren't they?
People don't like them.
People don't like them.
That's why the back door works.
But I still want to get back to the use of a word like asparagus when you're talking about a wine or a certain nut or a certain berry or currants.
Spencer, you missed my whole point to begin with. It's inferiority complex. These guys are throwing up defenses, and you try to figure out what asparagus. They're diffusing the effort. We're talking about wine here. They're talking about asparagus. For Christ's sake, how are we going to make success there?
Watch your language.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, I think Jack in Oakland has a comment about all of this as well. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that what I think Fran is doing is interesting. He's offering sort of the C. Dick and Jane run books. You know, if we're talking about language, they're good wines. They're simple. They tell a thick story. But you know, we need a dialogue, as your guest Leslie was talking about wine. We have a certain vocabulary that we can use. You know, for some people, the simple Dick and Jane books may be sufficient, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't still be able to read Shakespeare. There's a wonderful history of language.
But you're not equating using asparagus and currants with Shakespeare, are you?
Well, you know, absolutely. Why not? It's like saying Shakespeare could only use 11 words. It would have been fairly boring.
Leslie, go ahead.
You don't always have to use, which, by the way, is what I believe it was Michael in San Francisco was saying. There are reasons we use words to describe wine, whether it's a result of something you do in winemaking or something you do in the vineyard or an inherent trait in the grape variety. But you can use other language. You can use, you know, a silky, and people often compare it to personalities or to, you know, the feel of fabric or something like that. So it doesn't always have to be just those terms. There's lots of ways to describe wine, and it's just finding a common language that resonates with people.
Well, you know, we did a... Go ahead.
And if I could just add to that, I think, you know, Leslie, your guest had a good comment about baseball. Maybe you talk about a wine like your favorite pitcher, or maybe you refer to wine as, you know, maybe Zinfandel is Bruce Springsteen of great varieties. You know, it doesn't need to be asparagus, but what we're trying to do is find a common language where we can maybe talk about something that's interesting.
That's right.
And why can't, how is it bad that we connect with other people?
But I do argue that there are some people that wine snobbery is an issue, but I don't think it comes from people who truly love and appreciate wine.
Well, you know, but the people who are defending the language here are Leslie and maybe,
I'm
I haven't heard.
I'm as far from a wine snob as you
no,
can.
No, I know that, but you are a wine writer, and of course you need a language to describe the wine. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have anything to write. But why do we need to describe the way a wine tastes? We did a program at KQED 20 years ago called How Do You Talk About Pain? There are some things you just can't talk about. You got to say, you got to taste this wine because you're going to like the way it tastes. But why do you have to have a language to describe it? Maybe
Hopefully our language will get them to open up that bottle and try it, whether it's a bottle of Two Buck Chuck or whether it's a bottle of, you know, if you can afford it, good luck to you and go buy Screaming Eagle. So, you have to have a language to be able to inspire people and get them excited about trying wines and to communicate to one another. But again, as you know, I'm as far from a wine snob as there is. So you can find ways to describe wine. You absolutely can.
All right, we've got Ronaldo in Berkeley who's got a call. Hello, Ronaldo.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
As far as just one little comment on the language of the reviewers of the wine, I think that it's a wine lives or dies, you know, on whether it tastes good or not. And the language that's the fun part, when the reviewers say things and then you get to see if you agree or not. But I think the real problem for me is, it goes back to the restaurants. How can you deal with the fact that the restaurants are obviously using the cost of their wines to cover their overhead? And you know, it's just outrageous that you can't get a bottle of wine to go with a decent dinner for less than $30 anymore.
So how do you deal with that, Fred? Fred Frenzia?
First of all, I don't want to go off base on this subject, but that's one of my favorite subjects. The biggest thing holding back increasing sales in California wines or in wines in America are the fact that the restaurants are gouging people on their wines. Now, let me give you 2 seconds. If we can afford to sell wines to a retailer $2 and they sell it for $2, I can sell anyone in America good wines for $3 a bottle delivered anywhere in the United States, okay? Now, if they can sell that wine to the consumer for $10, offer it to the consumers as a choice in the restaurants, they triple their money. Isn't that enough? And that should be the war cry of every consumer out there. Go and demand that the restaurateur offer wines at prices you can afford to drink every day and enjoy it, not at prices they choose to make the profit and gouge the public with.
And many restaurants are doing that now. They're developing a sensible pricing policy and a
consumer
pricing
policy. Not enough of them. But yeah. I'm glad to hear there are some.
Yeah, me too. I'd like to find those restaurants because this is a real problem.
It's an issue.
$30 a bottle at a restaurant.
You, the restaurant patron, have got to make your demands known to them. What makes you want to drink wine or motivated? The salespeople are motivated the opposite way, like the restaurant. The higher price they sell to the restaurant, the more commission they make. The consumer's got to say, no, I'm not going to pay that. I don't care how much commission the distributor makes and the salesman make and the restaurant make. You offer us wine at a fair price.
You know, I remember I used to go to a restaurant called Little Joe's, which actually still exists. But when it first started, it was a little hole in the wall. And you go in there and you said, I want a glass of wine with my lunch. They didn't ask you what kind it was. They poured it out of a great big bottle. It was probably Cribari or something. And, it was a buck or two. I don't think you can do that anymore. Why, it's sort of too bad.
Why is it everyone that goes to Europe says, boy, the food was good, the wine was reasonable, I had it every day with lunch and dinner, and it didn't gouge me? Because it's a way of life over there. They don't overcharge.
Some of them do, I think.
All right. They catch on to the American way of doing things.
All right, James in Santa Rosa, a comment.
Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to say that this is extremely timely. I read an article yesterday in the Atlantic Monthly called The Case Against Foodies, and I think this overblown flowery language is nothing more than a sales ploy to pump up prices.
There you go.
And to intimidate people. I've got a few friends that pride themselves in being what I call personally wine snobs. I went to dinner one night, and they had purchased a bottle of wine that must have cost $75. And I think they were crestfallen when they saw that I wasn't very impressed with the wine. I think it's so much smoke and mirrors. I think the two-buck chuck thing is just doing wonders, and it is about economics. You're going to tell me that somebody who's born and raised in poor circumstances, who only has a certain amount of taste buds in their mouth, is not going to be able to afford the best, so-called best wine out there because they don't have the money to get that wine to flow across their taste buds? Give me a break.
All right. Well, we're going to take, speaking of a break, we are going to take a short break here. I just want to remind you who we've had on the show here, Leslie Sobracco, the wine consultant and author and host of Check Please Bay Area. On KQED Television, Julia Flynn Seiler with The Wall Street Journal, author of House of Mondavi, and Fred Franzia, who's the president and CEO of Bronco Wine Company, which makes Charles Shaw wine. A couple of quick comments from emails we've gotten. Is everyone involved in producing Charles Shaw wines receiving fair compensation for their labor? A labor question maybe we'll get to in a minute. Let's be honest, wine reviews are not very meaningful, from Jeff. And I have always been startled by the very reasonable price of restaurant wines in Europe. Well, we just made that point. So anyway, we're going to take a short break here for KQED to ask for your support. And we will be back in just a second with a little bit more of our discussion on Sirius. All right, so let's finish up our discussion here. We've got a few more minutes. And let's take another telephone call. We're going to talk to Sean in San Francisco.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for the call. I think it's a fascinating topic. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people in the Bay Area that know the price of everything and the value of nothing, as Oscar Wilde said, and they'll pay, you know, exorbitant amounts for certain things. And as a past caller said, I think you can liken it to art in the sense that, you know, some people will pay extreme amounts for a multiple print of Warhol, say, or Rembrandt. And what's the better piece of art? It's very subjective, very subjective. But I do know that there's oceans of wine in the Bay Area from every corner of the world coming here, and it's a very competitive market. And when you have that, you have to be very creative with language, marketing, and everything to try to sell, you know, the wines that are coming here. I mean, and I think the California producers have shot themselves in the foot time and again with their pricing. You know, everybody, as Mr. Franzia said, always complains about coming back and saying wines are so cheap from Europe. Well, you know, Australia figured that out and shipped boatloads of wine here at very, very, you know, low end prices and time and again. And I think California is starting to figure it out, you know.
All right. Well, Julia Seiler, the California wine industry is still doing pretty well, though.
Very, very well indeed. I wanted to share a story from my book, The House of Mondavi, that speaks to that point of really marketing smoke and mirrors a little bit. Opus One is one of the most famous wineries in Napa Valley. It's a joint venture between the Rothschilds and the Mondavi family back when it was started. And initially, they found themselves in the unusual position of having way too much wine, kind of what Fred is saying, out the back door. But instead of selling it to the bulk market and to people like Fred, what they ended up doing was selling, introducing a wine Opus by the Glass program to restaurants. So you could have a taste of this wine for $9. Back then, that was a lot of money, a glass.
Still is.
And still, it still is. And eventually, they adopted what a lot of Napa wineries do now, which is a list, a allocation list, which gave the perception of scarcity, even though they had too much wine on their hands. That perception led, in fact, to increased demand. And so it was a very clever marketing move on their part.
Fred Franzia, I'm curious to what you think if you were to compare your wine to, say, Opus One, since we just mentioned it. Would you say that there is a big difference in quality between those wines, or would you deny that?
Okay, Spencer, let me understand the question.
The question is, a really, really expensive wine versus your wine, is there a difference in quality?
Absolutely. Theirs is probably inferior to ours. I'm curious.
Now, seriously.
No, I am serious, and I think that they don't have the equipment we have or the means. We make over 1 million gallons of juice a day. And that's a quarter of a million. That's 400,000 cases a day.
So Opus One doesn't have the equipment that you have?
Absolutely not.
Fred, I've tasted both of them. I have to say Opus One is much better than Charles Shaw One. I'm so sorry to say this, but they would argue that it really has to do with where those grapes come from.
It's not about the equipment. It's about the place. It's about the vineyard.
All right, let me tell you, I think I told you the question before, Julia. Which way is that vineyard planted, north, south, or east or west in front?
Well, let's think about it. I think it's planted west to east.
Yeah, on the south side of the road, northeast on the north and south on the north side. Now, why do they have confusion there?
I don't know.
I'll tell you why, because they don't know the answer.
The answer is that if you plant north-south, you get equal sun. Isn't that your answer?
We plant all our grapes north-south. Do you cook a steak just on one side?
Not usually.
Okay, well, grapes are the same thing. They like to eat on both sides.
But there's much more to viticulture than just the way you plant and align the rows, you know.
I'll tell you one thing, there's a lot to cook, and if you cook it only on one side, there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Well, for our listeners, I just want to say Opus One sells for $160 a bottle, whereas...
Buy 80 bottles of mine for one Opus. Enjoy yourself.
But again, I go back to the point, and Spencer, the show is about wine snobbery. There... You can enjoy wine at every single price point, whether that is $5 and below, whether that is $50 and above. There is such a selection of wines. There's never been a selection of high-quality wines in America available to us as now.
All right.
So take my 80 bottles and take a chance and enjoy 80 days.
All right. Before we go, just a quick question to that, a quick answer, Fred, from that question we had on the email about fair compensation for labor. Are you paying more or less what they pay in the Napa Valley for labor?
Probably pay more. You know, we don't have to build ghettos for people to sleep in. We have people who actually live in houses over here and enjoy life.
Fred, that's not fair. Those are not ghettos. It's a great nonprofit organization for worker housing.
All right. This is a whole other show, which we probably won't ever do, but thank you all very much. Leslie Zabracco, wine author, consultant, host of Check Please Bay Area on KQED Television. Thanks very much, Leslie. Julia Flynn Seiler works for the Wall Street Journal, writes about wine, and just finished The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. And Fred Franzia, the president and CEO of the Bronco Wine Company, makers of the Charles Shaw brand, sold at Trader Joe's, nicknamed Two Buck Chuck. Thank you all very much. Been a fascinating discussion. We can all go out and have a glass of wine now. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.